Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show. And my special guest this week, Peter Hitchens. Peter, welcome to the show.
Well, good evening.
It's great to have you on. There are so many things I want to ask you about in relation to the state of Britain. I feel like you are probably our best known columnist when it comes to taking the temperature of the kingdom. But I guess I'll kick off with a broad issue, which is just about the new political era we find ourselves in. Some people call it Burnhamism, which I think is jumping the gun slightly. We've got a new prime minister. He's going to get to parliament shortly for the first time. Has he brought new vibes to the nation? What's your take on the Andy Burnham phenomenon?
Well, my position on politics, and I have occasion to rebuke people from this from time to time, is that you have to understand that the revolution has happened. That all the significant political, cultural, and moral events intended by the Long March to the Institutions, which began in the late 60s, are complete. There's nothing, therefore, to be surprised about. This is a society which welcomes mass immigration, for instance, and has done for some time under governments of both alleged political parties. This is a government which has very little interest, indeed, in protecting ordinary people from crime and disorder. But a great deal of interest in monitoring our speech and thought. And don't expect that to change or imagine that there's anything you can do to reform the police. Most of the things which I say are said really to try and get people to think, because I think that pursuing the truth and rational thought are virtues in themselves which people should do. I don't expect any of it to have any result because, as I say, the power has gone to people who are abusing it. And I have absolutely no means of taking that power back from them. And it's a fantasy to imagine that you can. I know there are some people who think that we're in an episode of Lord of the Rings, in which I apparently play the part of somebody called Denethor, who's a sort of traitor. But it's not, that's not the position. We're in the first, I suppose, and there are other European countries where this must be happening in similar ways, but I only know of it in detail here. We're in the first products of the Gramscian cultural and moral revolution, which the left was able to undertake once it had got rid of the millstone of Soviet communism, which, of course, vanished after 1991 and left it free to operate. My quick way of explaining this is to say that revolutionary socialism escaped through the breaches in the Berlin Wall made in 1989 and rushed into the West, where it immediately swept aside the tottering and exhausted institutions which remained and replaced them with its own, or alternatively filled up those institutions which were largely empty with its own ideas. That's where we're living. That's how it is. And to expect anything else or to imagine that the change in a prime minister in the same party will be of any political significance is, to me, faintly absurd. Obviously, it would be absurd to deny subtlety. Subtlety is important. It does make a difference if there is a Conservative government or a Labour government. For instance, I thought it was very foolish of people to vote heavily for reform at the last election in the clear knowledge that anybody could see that this would actually put Labour into office, because the Labour government will be worse. A Labour government will be actively destructive, and will know what it's doing, whereas a Conservative government will be failing to undo the destruction and won't understand what it's doing. Obviously, the second is preferable to the first. Neither is very good. But there are subtleties and there are differences, but they aren't worth getting particularly worked up about.
I want to come back onto reform in a moment, because you've said some interesting things about them and put the cat among the pigeons, rather, in the week that we're speaking. But just on the state of Britain, the state of politics, I do find myself feeling, I guess, more and more Peter Hitchens as I go about my daily life, because I am now in a situation where I witness someone openly stealing food from a cafe, I would say every single week. There is, in parts of London, the parts of London I visit, there is a real sense that things are decaying, the things are falling apart, the things aren't working. And lots of people feel exactly as you've just said, which is that whoever we vote for is probably not going to change. But is that a fatalistic message? You would say it's a true message, of course, but is there anything we could do to reverse the march through the institutions, or is it just that's it, done?
Well, it depends what you mean by fatalism. I'm often accused of defeatism, and I say, well, as I understand it, defeatism is a belief that you should embrace defeat and hurry it on that you actually desire. It was the revolutionary defeatism of the Bolsheviks. They wanted Russia to lose the war with Germany because they believed it would help them bring about the revolution. But I get accused of being defeatist because I say, we have been defeated. I didn't want to be defeated. And I would say, if challenged, that I nearly reduced myself to tears during the period about 2008 to 2010, trying to warn people of the disastrous results of David Cameron succeeding in taking over the Conservative Party on behalf of the Blairites. I lost friends. I lost huge amounts of sleep. I had to take part in embarrassing debates where I was the only person in the room who was saying what I was saying and nobody would pay any attention. It was like a nightmare, and it made me very distressed. At the end of it, I thought, well, I've had enough of that. It's only made me unhappy. It didn't work. And from now on, I will simply comment upon things as they are. And I'm now accused of having contributed to it. I absolutely rebut that. I did everything that was in my power as a national newspaper columnist, which isn't very much power, but it's some. I even approached other people in my position to try and get them to help me do it, and none of them would. I did everything in my power to avert it, and I couldn't avert it, and so now it's happened. In fact, that was the moment at which the trap closed. In my first book, The Abolition of Britain, I quoted, as I often do, the editor of Oz in the 1960s, Richard Neville. He's a very clever man, and he said, it's always stuck in my mind, there is an inch of difference between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, but it is in that inch of difference that we all live. And the result of the Blairization of the Conservative Party under Cameron was that inch closed. And one of the main features of life since the Cameron takeover has been an almost total collapse of true freedom of speech and thought. And if, for instance, like me, you think that it's not in Britain's national interest to pursue war with Russia, then basically you're treated as a traitor. There is no room for debate about this, whereas all the previous conflicts and troubles of the post-war period from Suez to Vietnam, it was perfectly legitimate for people who were patriots to say that they opposed these things, and they weren't dismissed as traitors or told they were Lord Haw-Haw or pumping out Russian propaganda, which I would never dream of doing. Now you are, and it's quite, anybody who can think will find themselves very rapidly on the dangerous edge of things. Well, that's all right in a free society. But in a society which has almost entirely forgotten how to be free and doesn't much want to be, it becomes increasingly alarming.
Many listeners will recall some of the stuff you wrote during the lockdown mania. You were on my podcast in that moment talking about some of the lockdown stuff. And that was another example of an era when there were certain things you couldn't say. And if you said them, you were in big trouble.
Well, I was accused of killing my own readers. On one occasion, I was actually specifically accused of helping to bring about the death of an individual who I'd never met or heard of. It was extraordinary. I don't know what the word really is for it, but it was Salem comes to Britain in many ways, and it was any lingering beliefs that I'd had that the British people had a special desire for liberty and a special readiness to stand up to authority were almost wholly dispelled by that. And so this is another thing about the use of what I do or say. Every few days, as it happens, somebody will approach me in Marks and Spencer's or on the street and say, I really wanted to say how grateful I am for what you said during what they still tend to call the lockdown, now called the panic. And I understand what they're saying. They were really, really concerned that there was no other voice, that they were thinking something, and they were beginning to think they'd gone crazy because no one was saying anything publicly in opposition to it. And by opposing it, I, at the least, I gave them some comfort. And that's, to me, I'm always very pleased when they say, because they really mean it. And it obviously did make a difference. And imagine being in such a circumstance and there being no voice against it. So it is worth it, but it doesn't achieve anything material.
Okay, speaking of the British people, you said that the panic was the moment, the COVID era was the moment when you lost the last bit.
No. That was a confirmation. It was the crucial moment was when the electorate, including many patriotic conservatives, voted for the Cameron takeover of the Conservative Party in the 2010 election. They didn't actually give him a majority. But alas, most people have forgotten that, and he did come into government and the endorsement happened. But it was the key moment at which the trap closed. After that, there really hasn't been any freedom or any true free debate in this country. Interestingly, one of the most important things Cameron did, which almost everybody forgets, and Blair is universally excoriated for the Iraq war, and rightly so. But Cameron gets a free pass for the Libyan war, which was in so many ways a catastrophe of stupidity and with disastrous outcomes for the whole of Europe, unforgivably. But it was war where it made itself felt most of all. There's this extraordinary desire in parts of the British establishment to go to war with various people.
Yeah, I completely agree on Libya. I often think, where's the reckoning with that? It never came. But on the question of the British people, I did want to, and the issue of out of control immigration or our broken borders, there is a growing dissent over that. I mean, I hear it from people every day. I'm sure you hear it from some of the people who message you or stop you. It's the issue over which people are incredibly angry. They feel that it's having a very destructive impact on society, and they are demanding, whether they're shouting into the ether or not, they are demanding that something be done about it. Do you think that's a positive development? Where do you see the immigration debate going next?
What have they got to suggest? I have no idea. The truth is that there was a period, and this is again encapsulated in something which I give incessant publicity to, which is the extraordinary article written by Michael Andrew Neither in the Evening Standard, in which he made it quite clear, without meaning to, that the Labour Party in the Blair era had a driving purpose to encourage large-scale legal migration with the intention, amongst other things, he uses this phrase of rubbing the right's nose in diversity, of changing the country. And I've said myself that in my Trotskyist days, we were generally in favour of large-scale migration as it was then, which is nothing compared to now, not because we particularly liked the migrants, but because we didn't particularly like Britain, and we could see that large numbers of new arrivals would change the country in ways which would almost certainly help the revolutionary cause. So you can see that. And since New Labour is basically the heir of the International Marxist Group, that's not particularly surprising that it should then behave that way. But this happened. And you may remember a man called, I think he was Sir Andrew Green then, he later became Lord Green, and he ran a thing called called Migration Watch, which over and over again, and he was totally respectable statistics, carefully gathered, sanely and responsibly enunciated on every opportunity you get. So this is what is happening. There is an enormous level of migration which the country cannot sustain. And nobody did anything. That was the point at which it could be done. Once people have arrived in this country, there is a grave difficulty. They become your neighbors. Now, I am a believing Christian, and I am therefore completely debarred from the sort of talk which I hear from so much of the supposed right now. It was perfectly possible, while Sir Andrew Green and others, and I gave what publicity I could to this myself, because he was obviously doing a serious job, while they were offering these warnings and while Andrew Neither was giving the game away, it was possible to limit this if anybody had cared. But above all forces in the country, again, the Conservative Party was not interested in doing so. And in fact, as we know, in office has done a great deal to increase legal migration. So that's that. What you do now, I don't know. What I can tell you is this. People who start talking about forcing people out of this country, I have to give them the benefit of the doubt that they don't actually know what they're talking about. The last century, the 20th century, was full of forced migrations of one kind or another. And there is not one of them which didn't dissolve into the most hideous barbarism. And I would have nothing to do with that as a policy ever in my life and never will.
Do you think people were aware of the extent of what was happening? I remember some of the things that were written at the time, including rubbing the right's nose in diversity and some of the other things that were said about using immigration to refashion a new country, post-traditional, post-conservative, etc. I remember some of that stuff, but I think people might be forgiven for not knowing the extent of it. I mean, if you think about the points-based system, of that's more recent, of course, and there are all these revelations coming out that the points-based system is like the fried chicken shop around the corner for where I'm speaking to you now. I recently discovered that it brought over 12 skilled workers. That's 12 people who would put chicken into a box for drunk blokes. That was happening up and down the country, and I think a lot of people weren't aware of the extent of it. Would you?
Well, I can't help that. It seemed to me to be quite clear from a pretty early stage that the Blair government was determined on very large scale immigration, and after that, it was clear that this was not going to be opposed by the Conservative Party, and therefore it would continue, and it has continued, and it's reached a very, very high level, and it has transformed the country. Not necessarily in the ways that it was intended to, but it has definitely done so, and here it has happened. So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the right, where the right is at. You've caused a bit of a stir over the past few days by putting forward your views on reform, also on restore.
I've said very little about reform. I mean, restore, I'd really rather not talk about it because I don't want to give the oxygen of publicity to a very stupid attempt by a very, in my view, stupid person to do something dishonest. So the less I talk about that, and the less anybody else does, the quicker it will, the waters will close over us, and the place of it will know it no more. It's all it deserves is obscurity. It was a revolting little episode.
Let me just ask you a little bit then about, I guess, some of the ideas that something like Restore embodies. You've already touched on them, the idea of mass deportations. You did say, which the only reason I'm raising this is because it made me smile. You did say you'd rather eat a raw sea urchin than even meet Rupert Lowe, far less associate yourself with his
party. Yes, it was a particular sauce that I suggested putting on it as well.
Oh, pondweed sauce.
Yes, warm pondweed sauce, yes.
So you obviously don't like the bloke. You obviously don't like Restore.
I don't know anything about him as a person. For all I know, he loves animals and is kind to children and gives to charity. What I do know is that the politics which he espouses and his failure to maintain a stern frontier on his right repel me greatly. And I think it's that's really all I want to say about that. You know perfectly well what I mean. I am not by any means a friend of Nigel Farage. There exists still what is to me an immensely amusing episode of Pints with Nigel, whatever it was called, on GB News, in which he set out to interview me, and I ended up, I rather think, interviewing him, and he ended it abruptly when it went wrong. I don't approve of Nigel Farage. I don't like his politics, but he has always had one thing to his credit. He has always made very sure that the frontier to his right is extremely well policed, guarded, and fenced. There are some people he will not have anything to do with, and good for him.
What do you make then of the argument that we're hearing quite a lot these days, including from pretty mainstream columnists, that the right is too divided? Restore even offered an idea of a pact with reform, which I think was given short shrift. But there's a lot of discussion. Why doesn't Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage mend the fences and do something? What do you make of that idea?
Well, nothing really, because again, this is toy politics. It bears the same relation to real politics as a train set does to the French railway system. It isn't real. It's just messing around. There isn't anything going on. Serious conservative politics in this country are dead because there isn't an electorate willing to support them. And so all you have are various button pushing, dog whistle blowing attempts to get largish numbers of people to vote, in many cases for policies which can't really be implemented. And you see in reforms flounderings in local government how difficult their pledges of cutting spending turn out to be. You know, society is so wedded to spending as ours, with so many people believing they're entitled to the outcome of it. It's very hard to do. And they didn't manage to do it. And it gives you a warning of what it would be like, as does indeed all the Doge rubbish from the early weeks of the Trump administration, and look where that's gone. There's so much posturing on the supposed political right, and a lot of it is a bit Trumpish, really, isn't it? Trump is not a serious thinker or a man with any real idea of what it is that he wants, and his supporters are basically driven by emotion rather than thought, and so they don't get anywhere. And now they've got, having voted for somebody who promised no more forever wars, they've got one of the most warmongering presidents in modern history. Again, it often comes around to war, doesn't it? Who is also destroying their economy by choking Strait of Hormuz, and indeed everybody else's economy too. The supposed right in the West is pretty unimpressive, isn't it? And Giorgia Meloni is supposedly on the right. Very, very few things that she's actually done in office have been particularly right-wing, because you can't do them. I don't know quite what would happen if Marine Le Pen became president of France, which I now think is entirely possible. But I think the experience might be a good deal more like Giorgia Meloni than people currently suspect.
Okay, let's speak about another woman then. What about, let's talk about Kemi Badenoch. I want to get your views on her. It seems to me that she has kind of discovered her mojo recently. I don't mean to use overly American phrases, but she does seem to have come into her own. She's making interesting noises. She's even talking about things like the ECHR. She's got lots of her shadow cabinet focusing on the crisis at the borders and so on. She does seem like a serious player, definitely an improvement on the Cameroon era, in my view. But do you think it's the same problem, that there are just things she won't be allowed to do? Is that what the problem is here?
I'm not sure she wants to do them, does she? I keep forgetting what it is she actually stands for, but I have things lingering in the back of my mind which are not terribly impressive, and things that she said. I'm not impressed. Why should I be? She's trying to do reform light. And the other thing is, these supposed recoveries, what do they amount to in actual polling? And she reshuffles her shadow cabinet, and it's just, as the Duke of Wellington said over some 1830s cabinet, the response of the thinking person is, who? Who are these people? And look at the Labour front bench again. Who are these people? When I was working down the Palace of Westminster in the 1980s, at least you could say to yourself there were some considerable persons there. Dennis Healy and Enoch Powell, neither of them to my political taste, but they were considerable thinkers. They also served in war. And Healy had been on the invasion beach at Anzio. He'd seen people blown to pieces near him. He knew things about the world. These people couldn't catch a bus. Who are they? What do they know? What is their qualification to be governing a medium-sized country with a decrepit nuclear arsenal? Why them? Why not your milkman, if you still have one, or somebody around the corner? Why them? What is it that qualifies them? I don't understand it. No, I'm not impressed by Kemi Badenoch-Humphrey.
I think a lot of people will be asking why them, and struggling to name any of them, including the actual front bench of the.
Well, there is a problem, isn't it? If you put people in a darkened room and gave them no notice and asked them who to name them, that most people, except the propeller heads, would be completely and utterly at a loss.
They absolutely would. I want to get your thoughts before we end. I want to get your thoughts on, I guess, the state of Britain beyond politics. You know, there are lots of things that you were right about. I think lots of people will agree with that. That's one of the reasons you've become something of a kind of meme machine amongst younger conservative minds on the internet, who see you as someone who predicted a lot of the stuff that's happening. If you look at, so for example, when I walk down the street, I very often smell people smoking marijuana, including first thing in the morning on their way to work, which blows my mind. We see things going to rack and ruin. There is a very strong sense in the country, I think, amongst lots of voters, that Britain isn't working, to borrow an old political slogan. Is there anything that can be done to reverse that? Or does that also require political?
Almost all the subjects on which I write, and it's a great difficulty writing a weekly column, because you say it and nothing happens, and you say it again in a different way and nothing happens, and then you say it again in a different way and nothing happens, and then you you try and say it by reporting on events which are the consequences of it, and nothing happens. Most of the subjects on which I write, I've been saying roughly the same thing since I was writing a column for the Daily Express. I left the Daily Express more than a quarter of a century ago. The example I'd like to give of this is the book, possibly the most important book that I've written, and I would, some people might say none of them are, but is the one which originally started out as A Brief History of Crime, became Abolition of Liberty, which is about what's wrong with the police and the criminal justice system, and also that the failure to confront crime and disorder eventually threatens the liberty of us all, which is, I think, demonstrable now. And I have pressed this book personally into the hands of a serving Home Secretary, a serving Commissioner of Metropolitan Police, a serving Old Bailey judge, and a serving Chief Constable, and saying to them, please, please, will you read this and let me know what you think? And I never received so much as a postcard from any of them or a letter of thanks, not a thing. And that seems to me to symbolize the problem of anybody who's outside the political establishment who wants to communicate original and critical thought to that establishment. They don't want to know. They are totally uninterested. They have their ideology. They know what they're being paid to do and what they were more or less hired to do by political parties, which exclude from the earliest stage anybody with any independence of mind. And they just don't care. So no, I'm currently in the middle of a project with my publishers to compile all these books into a single large volume called The Obituary of Britain, which now seems to me to be basically what I've become, the obituarist of a dead country. And that sums up my view. The country is dead. It's just really a matter of how long it'll take all the people who didn't notice the diseases it was suffering to notice that it's dead.
Do you think one of the dangers is, I mean, if we were being generous, we might call it self-policing communities. If we were being ungenerous, we might call it vigilantism. Because if you think about protests outside migrant hotels or even gatherings of young men, young British native men who are going into their town centres and saying enough is enough, will we see that if the police don't step up and do some of the things they ought to be doing rather than all the stuff they shouldn't be doing?
Well, it's been one of my major arguments. If you don't enforce the law, then people will try to enforce it themselves, and then you get chaos. And I hate chaos, and I'm not sympathetic to chaos from whatever direction it comes, because it's terrifying. I'm marked for life by a visit to Mogadishu when it was being run by the gangs some years ago, and I've seldom been so totally abjectly terrified in my life as living in a city where there was no order and where anything could happen. You had to have bodyguards with submachine guns, and if you didn't live in a guarded compound, then you would probably be dead in the morning. This is what happens when chaos comes and when order goes. So I'm terrified of that breaks of disorder, and it really does gravely worry me. I'm also terrified of the micro disorder which affects so many people. It's the sort of thing we're seeing in Middlesbrough now. Nothing to do with politics, just to do with the fact that the authority and law and punishment and deterrence and respect for anything are just vanishing. So a lot of this is indeed driven by the drugs, which have been effectively legalized for many years after a very assiduous campaign by the liberal classes back in the 60s.
Okay, Peter, my final question for you, I guess, is an issue close to your heart, which is the issue of freedom. You've already touched on it, especially the freedom to say unpopular things in times of crisis or times of panic. Surely that's not a lost cause or a lost fight, I should say. I mean, we've spoken in the past about the Magna Carta when we were celebrating the big anniversary of it. You've written at length about the importance of freedom of speech during the COVID panic, and you've written, of course, about the abolition of liberty more broadly. It is the golden thread that runs through, I guess, this kingdom, the belief in liberty or the search for liberty. That's not lost, is it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know why you're so confident. And it's okay if you're a national newspaper columnist, as I am, more or less. I can still say quite a lot of things that other people couldn't say. But if you're in any kind of workplace, particularly public sector workplaces, but an awful lot of private sector workplaces are the same now, you have to be very, very careful what you say and when you say it and to whom you say it And these codes are not enforced by gulags, they're enforced by the equally disastrous punishment of losing your job, which is just as much of a threat to people. So I would say there's not much freedom. And if you're unpopular and powerless, and I always raise here the case of Mr. Graham Phillips, a man now living in destitution in a ruined block of flats in Mariupol in Russian-occupied Ukraine, who at the moment groans under the most appalling punishments imposed on him by Her Majesty's government, then was, and the then Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, by decree, he's been sanctioned, which means his life is ruined. There was no court procedure, there was no jury, there was no due process. He's been able to go to court to protest against it, but the courts don't do anything to help him. And he's stuck out there, and very few people will raise this because he's not a particularly nice man. I don't like him. But he has actually been punished without trial, and that is a basic breach of the Magna Carta. And nothing, whatever happens to the people who've done it to him, and he has no recourse. And it's quite shocking to me. I've raised it a number of times, but very few people will take it up, and I have no idea what will happen to him. But if you really think liberty is flourishing in this country, you're safe, then just look at the case of Mr. Graham Phillips. As I say, unpleasant as he may be, that's not the point. Unpleasant people are often the targets of overmighty states. That the truth is that what he's been punished for without trial or jury or due process is what he said.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.